Support for WAER Original Podcasts comes from California Closets of Syracuse, located in DeWitt. California Closets can help you get your entire home organized with custom-designed storage solutions for the home office, kitchen pantry, closets, and more. Online at californiaclosets.com.
Hollywood has been a busy place not only for writers and actors and directors, but also for reporters. In Hollywood's golden years, there were entertainment reporters who were almost as powerful as the stars and studio moguls they reported on. Hedda Hopper, as one example, arrived in Hollywood as an aspiring movie actor, but switched to writing a gossip column for the Washington Herald in 1935. By the height of her career in the 1940s, her column was read by more than 35 million people, and she had the power to make or break the careers of almost anyone. Of course, entertainment reporters have trafficked in more than just gossip. Some have gone on to fame as critics like Roger Ebert or A.O. Scott, or given readers a behind-the-scenes look at how movies get made and how they fail. Times, however, have changed. The expansion of digital technologies and social media now mean that anyone with a website, YouTube channel, or Twitter account can write their own reviews, stories, and opinions. I'm your host, Kendall Phillips, and on this episode of Pop Life, we'll be inquiring into the changing nature of entertainment journalism. My guest in this inquiry is Brandon Katz. Brandon has written for venues like Forbes and The Observer and is currently host and content creator for Morning Brew. Brandon, welcome to Pop Life.
Thank you so much for having me, Kendall, and what a wonderful, eloquent, articulate intro that brought me down memory lane of some of my passionate origins for entertainment journalism. So thank you for that.
Well, actually, that's a perfect segue to my first question. So I know you studied journalism at George Mason, but when did you know you wanted to be a reporter? When did the reporter bug bite you?
That's a good question, because it's a bit of a kind of journey to a conclusion. I would say I knew from high school that I wanted to be involved in the pop culture field. So I did involve myself in a diverse mix of kind of cross-platform media activity so I could, you know, develop the necessary storytelling skills and put together a track record of experience to make my way in the media industry. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do within that space at first. So I started off as a sports reporter. I love sports. But I did end up transitioning to entertainment after a couple of years, because that's where my deepest passion has always been. And I like to consider myself overall a proud couch potato. And I remember my parents gently but firmly telling me as a kid that I can't make a living out of watching TV and movies. So when I began covering Hollywood full time, I was able to kind of momentarily gloat in a "who's laughing now, mom and dad" kind of moment. So I was very, very grateful for that. And I think I kind of really landed on entertainment journalism as my full-time passion and career a couple years out of college, when I had been working full-time as a sports reporter, but also doing a lot of freelancing. And I realized, you know, I want to be a multimedia storyteller, someone who's writing, who's podcasting, who's on camera, and doing a lot of different things to provide some context and commentary to entertainment junkies like myself.
But would you say for you was the initial passion an interest in pop culture? And I would count sports sort of broadly in that sort of world of entertainment and engagement and things. Or was it the desire to be a reporter? What was really the driving force that got you into the career you're in now?
It was definitely the passion for pop culture first. And then I was in high school and I was thinking, what am I good at? Well, I was always good in English class. I was always good at writing essays or, you know, putting together presentations or essentially synthesizing larger ideas into kind of easily digestible tidbits for a quote unquote audience. And, you know, I always enjoyed kind of writing and trying to tell a creative story that was still fact-based, like, you know, an article about sports or entertainment. So I kind of realized that was a good melding of my skills, passions, and it led itself to an actual career. So when I was 14, 15 too, I also wanted to be a stand-up comedian, and I was performing in New York City, but I very quickly realized that an actual salary was much more beneficial than free Bud Lights.
Well, you know, for some people, they make that choice. Brandon, I think it was a wise choice for you. Health insurance all the nachos you can eat after the set. So I'm wondering about, you know, that interest in pop culture. And I guess I'm wanting to go back to when you were studying journalism at George Mason, which is a very fine institution. Was an interest in sports and pop culture, was that embraced within the journalism program, or was it seen as less than serious? I guess there's always that kind of tension between kind of hard news and then the kind of fun news.
I will say that quite a few journalism professors wanted to stamp out any flowery language, any creative storytelling, and get down to just the facts. But in their defense, they were trying to teach me fact-based reporting. They were trying to teach me the basics of journalism. It wasn't necessarily that they were against it. They were just trying to at least give me a foundation to build off of as I went on and kind of did my own things. But overall, no, sports and entertainment certainly weren't looked down on. They were really teaching us the ability to craft a narrative, to convey information to an audience in entertaining ways, and simply to ask the right questions and learn how to kind of acknowledge these trends that we needed to track. They didn't care in what way we use those skills. They were just trying to give us the skills to start with. And I was really always grateful and appreciative because they have one hell of a media program down there and a lot of great extracurricular activities. I was on, you know, I was writing for the newspaper. I was on a radio station. I was doing a lot of different things, and I was lucky to be in a university that supported and embraced all of those different fields, and in a location right outside Washington, D.C., where I had access to a lot of internships that would help give me kind of boots on the ground training to become a journalist.
Sure. And I'm wondering about, you know, in terms of that, you know, thinking about that great preparation and then moves you into this career where you're getting to do a lot of the things you love, right? You love pop culture. Mm-hmm. You love engaging. You love storytelling. You've got multiple multimedia platforms to tell those stories. But I wanted to step back and ask, think about, what do you hope your reporting achieves, right? Beyond, you know, paying the bills and giving you the lifestyle you're looking for the readers, what do you think the purpose of entertainment journalism or pop culture journalism broadly, what's the purpose of that?
Wait, Kendall, are you saying there's more to life than paying bills? I don't think that's what I've been brought up to know in modern American society.
Well, you got to be able to afford a Tesla. That's the first thing. But anyway, yeah, no.
Exactly. Overall, I have done, you know, fact-based reporting and everything, you know, straightforward journalism. But I myself don't necessarily consider myself a journalist. I'd like to think of myself more as overall a commentator. And what I'm trying to do most with my entertainment coverage is not only provide insight into what can be a very nebulous, dense, confusing industry at times in terms of the business of Hollywood, but also when I'm talking about more kind of filmic analysis and critiquing, helping audiences understand why they feel the way they do about certain TV shows and movies, why certain scenes are making them feel X, Y, and Z. I think helping them understand their own feelings and what a piece of entertainment is trying to accomplish and how it's going about doing that is a great tool to appreciating the entertainment itself more, or at the very least, knowing whether or not a piece of entertainment is worth your time, because the consumer's time these days is pretty valuable and they want to pick the winners and the winners only, which I can appreciate.
No, I will say one of the things I've always admired about your work, and I have admired your work, is I always thought you do a wonderful job of kind of bridging those different parts of the entertainment industry, because there's certainly that industry side, the variety, the behind the scenes sort of industrial side of how the sausage gets made. And then there's the broader kind of cultural, which includes both the sort of why someone would want to go see this movie or watch a TV show, and kind of thinking about why that matters, you know, what the cultural part is. So I'm wondering if that's, do you sort of see that as part of your work, is to bridge those and make all those areas accessible so people kind of see the full spectrum of the entertainment industry?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the kind words very much. And I will say that if I ever had a professor in college like you who taught a class about Marvel, I would just be over the moon excited. So I'm sad that our age gap didn't kind of align where I could have taken that class, because I would have loved it. But to your question, absolutely. I think what I love, I always like to joke that I hate that I love the Oscars so much, because it's such a flawed, outdated, archaic institution that seems to get everything wrong. It's always tone deaf. But why I love the Oscars is because you're usually looking at a crop of high quality films that really summarize the subconscious or very, very literal conscious of the culture in that given year. So I think every year that crop of films, or even at the Emmys, that crop of TV shows really reflect the changing attitudes and moods and essentially the kind of top of mind cultural topics that are driving conversation in that time period. And I think absolutely, I would never say that art is a huge savior of culture. I think a lot of times it can do a lot of bad, but it can change perceptions. It can teach valuable lessons like tolerance and representation and morality. So I really do find there's a great way to relate to, there's a great way to relate to real life through entertainment. And I think focusing on that is a wonderful part of my job that, I love, that I help give insight into what we're feeling as a group of people at a time. And then if we want to turn it towards the industry, because again, that's a lot of nuts and bolts. It's a lot of dollar signs. It's a lot of spreadsheets. It's so fascinating for me to see the chess match strategies at play. Why this streamer is doing this, why that company is pivoting towards this, what kind of people are they trying to recruit? It says so much about the changing tides of entertainment at any given time. And it gives you a sneak peek at what the future of this industry might have in store when you're analyzing the strategies of today. So I find so many different elements of the Hollywood industry compelling for such a variety of reasons. I kind of feel spoiled, like a kid in a candy shop, having all of this amazing storylines to kind of nitpick and share with all my people who like to pay attention to what I produce.
No, and you do a great job. But thinking about those sort of changing tides of industry, I want to shift the focus a little bit away from the entertainment industry to, I guess, your industry, which is sort of layered around that, wrapped around it like a pretzel, the entertainment journalism industry. And so you are a journalist. You have a job title. You work for an official institution. You've written for, what would be considered kind of mainstream media journalistic outlets. I'm wondering, in your time, like, how has that evolved and changed, the kind of job of the entertainment reporter?
Absolutely. And I think this is a really important question because I think it underlines both great things and terrible things about this industry. So in my 8 years in media, I have seen like a proliferation of entertainment-focused outlets across the internet. And I think this has blurred the lines of what is firsthand reporting journalism, what is kind of aggregate commentary, and legitimacy of information. And as a consumer, I think that's really, really hard to navigate because you don't know who to trust and why. And I think it's only getting more difficult. I think within that, there's also been this massive pivot to video for both economic and technological reasons, because new platforms are popping up that make video more accessible, more doable. It seems that, you know, anyone who's been paying attention in the last 20 years, no, print journalism is dying. So as we've kind of shift, it's changed what a reporter is meant to be as well, because, you know, social media, it's a new, now a projection of your personality. And if you want to be a YouTube commentator, audiences are buying more into who you are and your entertainment value than they are in any sort of sound reporting or fact-based journalism. And I think the extension of that is the access audiences now have to you. And we've seen toxic fans hurl terrible vitriol and hostile toxicity at reporters and critics, which is simply awful. You know, I've had to deal with like death threats, anti-Semitic remarks, all sorts of insults levied at me. And frankly, I, as a white man, have it much better and easier than most critics in this space. I have non-white and female friends and colleagues that are forced to deal with truly heinous online treatment. So I think in terms of the changes, our relationship with our audience has become unhealthier. And even though there's been this explosion in new voices and diverse representation in terms of who can cover the entertainment industry, and that's great, it has also led to, well, I would say, if not irresponsible voices becoming popular, downright harmful voices becoming popular. And that leads to this whole subculture of fans that follow their lead and further kind of erode the field, if that makes sense.
Yeah, do you think part of that is you know, I think about the again, I'm a bit older, so I remember the years, you know, when you would have said the Times critic says, or the New Yorker critic says, or the Atlantic critic says. So there was almost as much an emphasis on the institution as there would have been on Gene Siskel or Roger Ebert or Pauline Kael or whoever it might be. And now, as you're simultaneously getting more voices and more personalized voices, so, you know, your brand and Katz, you're not speaking for, you know, whatever institution you're working for. Do you think that is the loss of that institutional gatekeeper, the loss of that institutional voice, so that we don't really know who the institution is, we know the personality or the critic or the person.
Yeah, I think there's pros and cons to that. A little bit like I mentioned before, I think on one hand, the kind of proliferation of platforms and the ability for an individual to carve out their own niche is great because we can now have so much more opportunity. And that means that the traditionally male and white dominated entertainment journalism field has suddenly exploded with fresh voices and perspectives that have been long overdue. We needed to inject them into the culture conversation. It also empowers the journalist slash critic slash commentator itself, as opposed to us all feeding these, you know, what can be very large conglomerates and media enterprises that aren't necessarily looking out for the individual, they're looking out for their bottom line. So I think in that regard, it is good. On the flip side, it's difficult because now you have a de-emphasis on quality journalistic ethics that many of these media institutions do preach and do hold their employees to a high standards. And so when that begins to weaken and lessen that institution, so does the subsequent reporting and, you know, critic opinion pieces and things like that. So there's very much a give and take going on at the moment. And I think it's up to us to sift through the kind of BS pros and cons and kind of really focus on the specific criteria we value most. And that's going to be a case by case individual basis. So it's a hard thing to absorb as a consumer right now. It's like you said, it's not as easy as like, well, a new movie's coming out, let me check the times.
Right. Or I'll watch Siskel and Ebert, which I used to watch, and I would see if they get two thumbs up, I would know. But I'm wondering if just to push a little further on this, I guess, relationship between trust and toxicity, because I do think if I had a dollar for every time I've clicked on one of those clickbait saying, this casting will reveal the next plan of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I read and there's absolutely no content there that anyone could find, or this secret part of the poster, and it just ends up being someone's theory that purple leads to Kang or whatever it might be, I would retire. I'd be on the coast of Maine sipping a margarita or something. Do you think that's part of it, though, as there's more and more proliferation and less, again, the kind of gatekeeping, the expectations of not only the ethics, but the facts, like people doing their actual work? And I'm wondering if that contributes to a sense that none of this matters and it's all kind of ends up maybe being a kind of toxic stew.
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, through no fault of our own, sometimes we are stirring the toxic stew because, yes, there are so many more voices and platforms out there, but that means there's more competitors competing for the same pie of audience attention. And that is what has given rise to clickbait titles and kind of content farms that are simply chasing SEO trends. And you know what? A lot of the times you can marry a blatant SEO trend chase. So you're trying to attack something that's highly clickable, highly searchable right now with really, really quality storytelling, whether it be an opinion piece, whether it be a really helpful explainer that adds context and instruction for people who are trying to figure out where to access something or how to certainly do something. But too often, I think we see exactly what you're talking about, completely vague, baseless articles that are simply content for content's sake. They are just trying to drive clicks and sell ads and nothing more. And it's hard because at the end of the day, the media industry, the entertainment media industry is an industry. It is a business. I understand that making money is part of it. We can't divorce ourselves from the capitalistic structure we exist in just because we want to, you know, write our flowery 1,000 word essay on a single scene in television history. But we have to be able to have a balance. We have to be able to strike a balance between good practical journalism that informs people, that helps people, that keeps them abreast of the relevant updates that they want and need to know about with, yeah, something a little bit more entertaining. And perhaps it's not the most groundbreaking all the president's men type of story, but there's got to be value in it. We can't just throw out empty, vague trash simply to fill our quotas. And it's tough because like we've been talking about, there's so much clutter to cut through these days that it is becoming increasingly difficult to keep sites alive by just sticking to the status quo of, you know, 15 years ago and very intellectual writing, such as maybe what Grantland used to do, is sadly fallen by the wayside because it doesn't attract enough readership.
Yeah, it seems you're almost kind of caught between, on the one hand, you know, we also have we haven't talked about, but the industry itself. And I guess I think of Marvel as a great example of pumping out a lot of reporting. Like, they are very good at the endless stream of videos and tweets and behind the scenes and all the Disney Plus stuff. And so there's this massive amount of information coming from the industry, which is clearly self-serving. You get this enormous number of people, sort of just anybody who has a Twitter account or something else, popping up and offering their opinion. And there's somewhere in the middle is you and your kindred reporters trying to navigate the middle of that space.
Yeah, and it's not easy. And I think further complicating that matters, I'm glad you brought up Twitter. We now have Twitter accounts dedicated solely to aggregating news. And while they'll often give credit to the original reporter or the original outlet, we are shrinking and minimizing entertainment journalism and storytelling to the bare minimum. I mean, first it was long form print journalism. Then it was, you know, still kind of long form online journalism. Then it became videos. Now it's TikToks. Now it's like a single tweet. We keep synthesizing smaller and smaller to the point where I feel like all context and nuance is lost. And I've always felt this in politics. And I feel like the same has happened in the entertainment community, in that everyone is being dragged to the polar opposite ends of the spectrum. There is no centrism anymore. Everything is either the worst thing ever or the best thing ever. And obviously the shades of gray are going to get lost as the reporting methods and information consumption becomes minimized to the point where, okay, it's a 140 character tweet and that's all the information and context you're going to get. Everyone's going to be angry and elicit such a massive response when nobody's allowed to explain themselves anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a culture of hyperbole. You know, not everything is, you know, desperate or crushed or destroyed or the greatest or the worst. There's a loss of nuance in a world where everything must be done so, so quickly. And yet, you know, and you've sort of begun to address this a little bit. It's also wonderful that anybody can pop up and say, I just watched Coda and it really moved me. Or I just watched, you know, the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre and it really upset me, right? That opportunity. So I'm wondering, for you as a professional journalist, looking at people, whether they're just tweeting from their own account or they're creating their own YouTube channel and just starting to sort of create their own vlogs or writing blogs, what do you look at the role of kind of everyday citizen, the kind of citizen journalist, if you will? What's their role in the entertainment industry?
Well, everyone at this point, excuse me, sorry about that. Everyone at this point basically can be their own reporter thanks to modern technology, you know? And I think this has created a social environment in which vast amounts of people need to know everything, from the exact plot details of an upcoming blockbuster and all the spoilers it contains to the intimate details of celebrity personal lives. And I think that invasiveness and overexposure is unhealthy on multiple levels. You know, it's given audiences a sense of entitlement that will never erode, and that then heightens their interactions and reactions to anything online that they deem outside their own narrative. So that culture of hyperbole that we just talked about. So I think that is one of the big downsides. On the flip side, I think the fact that an average fan can express their opinions, as long as they're doing it in an appropriate, you know, non-hostile, non-toxic way, is great. Because it just means people are engaging with what they're passionate about on a more regular basis. Like we've been saying, I don't want to be pulled to the opposite ends of the extremes. You know, I think there is good and bad in what is going on in entertainment media these days. And I think the role of the quote unquote citizen journalist is to find that middle ground, maybe not in their opinion. You can say something is terrible, but in terms of their rhetoric and how they're interacting with other journalists and other citizens who are just mere audience members who want to talk about the things they love. Because if we can have a civil discourse, we can go on disagreeing forever. That's great. I'm much more interested in someone who doesn't share my opinion, as long as they do it respectfully, than I am in someone who goes, "You're right, Brandon. I don't need a yes man on Twitter. I need someone who's like, I disagree respectfully. Have you ever considered X, Y, and Z?" I'm like, oh, wow. Now I have a new perspective to consider that maybe I didn't think of, because my lens is my lens. We can all only control our lenses through which we filter entertainment. And that's obviously built on a number of factors, including kind of how we grew up and everything. So when you can introduce new perspectives that alter your lens and allow you to see things in a different way, that's great. We just got to do it in a way that is reminiscent of kind of, I feel like, discourse of years ago, where we still recognize that we may be on opposite sides, but you're still a human, I'm still a human, and we ultimately love the same thing, and that's great.
Well, the good old days of Siskel and Ebert, they fought like cats and dogs, but you knew they were always friends. Now, I will say, for me, I tend to want to read a review of a film after I've seen it. And particularly if I really liked it or if I really didn't like it, I like to go look at reviews, as you say, to get that perspective and say, oh, I didn't see it that way. Oh, yes, you saw it the way I did. And just trying to explore those different opinions. But the other thing, I wonder if you have a thought on this, what I would call a trend, and you mentioned it earlier, the kind of endless fan speculation, right? It's not just that they want to know every plot point, every cast member, they want the behind the scene photos, but there's a proliferation of this kind of, you know, fan discourse, if you will, that's this kind of endless speculation of what they think might happen and the creation of theories of what the film might be about or how this character may or may not fit in, which is oddly not fact-based, but really feeding that hunger for knowing what the product's going to be before the product even exists.
Yeah, and it's tough because when something doesn't meet someone's invented expectations, their immediate reaction is extreme negativity. They want to lash out. And we have to take into account that the entertainers creating this content, this art, they may not have the same expectations right. We do. They have their own vision, and that's perfectly okay. We need to be able to set our idea of what things should be aside. You know, we can certainly go in with some hopes, with some, you know, expectations of what we want to see happen, but we can't automatically describe or categorize something as terrible or awful or junk just because it didn't follow the exact story we laid out in our minds. And we got to be very careful about that. I'm guilty of it sometimes as well. And you would think someone who's kind of so close and on the inside of this phenomenon would be able to recognize and avoid that. But even I fall prey to it too. So I'm not saying anyone's a bad person because that happens. I'm just saying we need to be conscious that art is art for a reason. It's meant to invoke and elicit big reactions. It's meant to sometimes subvert expectations. And it's meant to be a very unique, specific vision that is not going to match up with the masses every time. And that's okay. Everyone, deep breath, you know, sip a beer and relax.
If I only wanted to see the world the way I see it, I'd just stay at home, right? So you're absolutely right, my opportunity to see things differently. Speaking of differently, where do you see the future? Where is this going to go in the next 5 or 10 years in terms of entertainment journalism broadly?
That's a really good question. It's, you know, kind of what we were just talking about. I feel like we have started to see trouble in terms of the access and proliferation of voices, and that audiences now have the ability to create echo chambers because they are selectively tuning into the voices and personalities that only reflect their pre-existing ideas and notions. And again, we're all guilty of it in some form at some times. I know I am. But despite the internet allowing entertainment journalism to expand and broaden in this great, exciting way, it's also enabled folks to constrict the flow of information and opinions they let into their own worlds. And that can be very problematic. And we've seen it already give rise to certain personalities that are, you know, at best untrustworthy and at worst downright harmful. And I think it's frightening to me too, because I kind of still feel, and excuse the pessimism here, but I still feel like we're in the early stages of entertainment journalism's decay. Sure. You know, toxic fandoms, which are usually small but vocal minorities, they're feeling increasingly empowered and entitled to bully until they get what they want. And studios continue to only work closely with the trade outlets, with very deserving, very legitimate, websites and individuals with followings outside of that small bubble, really not being given the access that they deserve or require to do their jobs the best they can. And I think it's creating this haves versus have-nots divide in entertainment media. It's creating this boiling resentment. You know, social media platforms have led to a rise in misinformation and personalities using kind of false scoops and problematic rhetoric to appeal to a very specific subset of fans. So that waterfall of negatives, I do apologize again, because I don't mean to be grim and dour, but I think the future of entertainment journalism is very murky. It's a very murky world, built around more strategic brands and personalities than transparency and accuracy. And opinion will always have a place in entertainment coverage because, you know, it's art, it's subjective. We want to hear your analysis because maybe you're very eloquent and good at speaking. But again, all of that contributes to people being pulled to the extremes. And how is a quality outlet that's dedicated to good, transparent journalism and really, really well thought out and articulate and intelligent critiques, how are they supposed to survive when that's not drawing the clicks? When the people who are being hyperbolic and stirring the stew pot and deliberately stoking flames of toxicity, they're garnering all of the attention, leaving the people who are trying to do it right out in the cold. And that is a very frightening thought to me. That's the end of my rant. I won't depress anybody anymore.
Well, when that happens, you can always go back to the Miller Lite at the comedy clubs in New York, and you'll be fine. I'm sure you'll make it. No, I think you're right. I think there's a lot of negativity. I do still believe, though, and I think of your work and a lot of other folks writing for, you know, kind of established venues, that there's still a value in that kind of intelligent, well-based, fact-based reporting. And I think somehow, and I'm with you, I don't see how, but somehow the world will right itself or there'll be some evolution that will let that kind of intelligent insight continue to circulate.
Definitely. And listen, there's a handful of people that I still follow religiously that I love in this space that are absolutely great at what they do. And they're, you know, most of them are extremely successful, but they deserve even more of an audience and even more attention because they are just the creme de la creme of, you know, whether that be entertainment industry analyst or, you know, creative writers kind of critiquing the art and what it means. So there's still many, many great voices out there.
And certainly among those is you. Thank you, Brandon. And now, as all our regular listeners know, we never let our great experts go just after giving us their insights. We want to know more about them. We want to learn about their pop culture interests. And we begin that segment with a little game, Brandon, we call the Fast Five. And the Fast Five, I'm going to ask you five quick choice questions, either or questions, this time based on our mutual love of superheroes. So if you're ready, Brandon, let's start the Fast Five with question number one. Who is more deserving of their own standalone big-budget film? The X-Men character Dazzler, who turns sound into disco lights, or Batmite, the magical imp who acts like Batman?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm going with Dazzler. I love the X-Men. I think that character is pretty underrated in the grand scheme of kind of comic book lore. So yeah, I'm going Dazzler.
I'm with you because I have a lot of Dazzler fan friends who will beat me up for saying disco lights. Question number two, who do you think would be more fun at a party, Howard the Duck or Harley Quinn?
Oof. I mean, Harley Quinn, but only if you're on her good side. You know, I would definitely be that kind of starstruck fanboy who is sucking up to them to make sure that they don't hate me, which is pathetic in and of itself, but also might save my life. So, you know what? I'm not going to hold myself too accountable.
I'm going with the duck because I like the martinis. Question number three, Brandon, who would you rather be in the clutches of? Would it be Dr. Doom or Joker?
Oh, my God. That is horrible. Oh, my God. Listen, neither is a great option. You know, most likely I'm not getting out of either situation unscathed, but I got to go with Dr. Doom.
I think you're probably at least going to die in some rational manner. So question number four, logically, if you're in the clutches of that major supervillain, who would you most want to have coming to your rescue? Would it be the mighty Thor or Batman?
Kendall, you are really putting me on the spot with some excellent questions. Thor is more powerful, but I trust Batman more.
The right answer is always Batman. You're exactly right. No, there's no doubt. Yeah. So the final of our tough pop life, and pop life is a tough life here, Brandon. Our fifth and final question in the Fast Five is, who would you rather sit down and have a cup of coffee with? Would it be Groot or Swamp Thing?
That's a great question. That is a great question. I think Swamp Thing, because, listen, I love Groot, but I think I could talk about more worldly issues that are currently facing our planet right here and now with Swamp Thing, and you know, that might be more useful than learning about a cosmos I may never visit.
This is right. Swamp Thing seems like probably up on current events. So, Brandon, let me ask finally, what are you loving, listening to, playing, watching? What is in your pop culture radar at the moment?
Great question. I'm always juggling a handful of things. So I'm currently watching Tokyo Vice screeners, and that comes out on HBO Max soon. The pilot is directed by Michael Mann, so very cool. I'm watching The Dropout on Hulu, Severance on Apple TV+, The Gilded Age on HBO. I just watched Windfall on Netflix, a nice little chamber piece movie with a good cast, Jason Segel, Jesse Plemons, and Lily Collins. I enjoyed it, pretty solid. And I'm really, really, really excited to hopefully see soon Everything Everywhere All at Once, the A24 multiverse movie starring the incomparable Michelle Yeoh, who I love.
No, those are some amazing shows and a lot of things that I'm looking forward to. Unfortunately, podcasters don't get screeners, so I'll have to wait until they come out for the regular citizens. Thanks to Brandon for helping us begin our inquiry into entertainment journalism, and I'll invite our listeners to tune in as we continue this series by chatting with Khalil Johnson, a management consultant who spends his evenings writing pop culture reviews for the website Punch Drunk Critics. And to our listeners, I'll remind you that whether you hear about a new pop culture trend on the cover of The Hollywood Reporter or on TikTok, odds are that we'll be talking about it here on Pop Life. I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Pop Life, a production of WAER, Syracuse Public Media. You can find archived episodes at WAER.org. And don't forget to subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen for automatic delivery of new episodes.